Kerry Bennett, thanks again for coming on the Regenerative Health Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Max. I'm excited to chat.
So I'd like to talk and do a deep dive on water, both the theory and the practicalities of it, because there's a lot of uncertainty and there can be a lot of different advice that people get about water. But maybe we could start with your general approach and general structure and thought process about water and its role in biology.
Yeah, sure. You know, water, understanding water and how it behaves inside of us was really the aha moment for me as a clinician, both in helping heal my own body, my own chronic illness journey, and then also with so many clients. And it's because, as you know, Max, the water inside of us, really, it does everything. And so it's of utmost importance to maintain it. And there's multiple ways that we can do that. Certain people who have listened to your podcast before have heard the term exclusion zone water or EZ water, but I would love to really describe how truly important this substance is for so many different levels. If you're cool, if we can go there.
Please, please do.
Okay. So, this beautiful water inside of us is not in the same state as we think of when we think of the liquid water in a glass. So when most of us have learned about water at some point through our schooling, we were taught that water exists in three states. It exists as in a crystalline state, which we would call ice, a solid. It exists in a liquid state, which we would just assume with water in a glass. And it exists as a gas, which would be steam. And the water inside of us actually exists in a fourth state that falls in between solid and liquid. And it's more of a gel-like texture, like what we would call maybe gelatin or jello. It has maybe more of a gel-like consistency to it. And that's not the most important thing about it. It's the properties that the water has when it's in that state that really impacts, I want to say, all of biology. And so in order to understand how this happens or why this happens, we have to recognize how the water molecules in this state interact with each other. That is the key here. Because if I were to take these H2O molecules and like look at them, if I could physically see them under a microscope, let's say, and I could look at how they exist in ice, I would see that the H2Os are bonded together in very organized, structured ways. We would call it a crystalline organization because literally they're making these hexagonal shapes as they link together. And if I were to take a look at liquid water underneath this type of a molecular microscope, I would see that the water doesn't have any organization to it or any rhyme or reason, right? And that's not exactly true. We can go into the nuances of that structured water at some point if you want to as well. But in general, there's a much more random bonding with these water molecules so that there doesn't appear to be much organization. And when we take the water inside of our cells, let's say, and if we were to look at that, the organization of that underneath the microscope, we would see that it also has this very organized hexagonal structure. So it has structured itself into a crystalline organization. However, it still maintains liquid properties. Not quite as fluid as water, like true water, but very much still has some fluid qualities to it. And so that gives this state of water a state that I would call liquid crystalline state. And liquid crystals have amazing properties. And so I'd love to go into those at some point, but then also talk about how this water, as it organizes itself like this, has charge as well. And that charge is really truly this vital energy or this electricity that our cells use in order to operate. So that's just a general intro. I'm ready to go deeper wherever you want.
Yeah, that's a very good introduction. And it's something that I don't think biology, as we are taught in medical school or biomedical science, is appreciating. So where is the state of the art compared to these more traditional or so-called centralized schools of thought compared to the information that you've just presented? Why is there a disconnect here?
I mean, I think the disconnect is there because water and optimizing the water in the bodies really doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of money. And as water is studied, it's always just been considered it's there, right? It's what in traditional mainstream medical literature, it's an inert solvent, basically. So we need it. because things have to dissolve into it and move through it and reactions have to take place in it. But it doesn't actually, they believe it doesn't actually participate in any of the activity. And when in fact, all the activity takes place because of the water and through the water. And so the disconnect, I'm certain, has to do with lack of financial incentive when it comes to being able to, so, you know, make a ton of money off of this. And it's unfortunate because I find understanding biology through the lens of water to be so simplifying. We've looked at things in such disparate ways, and water really is this unifying factor in terms of how, in terms of even things like mind-body medicine and how that works, how our environment can change gene expression. All of this is happening through water. And so it's quite a brilliant thing to recognize. And if we can address the water, we're no longer addressing separate systems, right? It's not no longer the systems biology of, oh, you have heart issues, we're going to address your heart, or you have kidney issues, we're going to address your kidney. No, it becomes, we have to tend to the status of the water inside of you. And when we do, that has an overall revitalizing effect on the entire organism.
Yeah. And the pioneers of this water research, maybe we can make the point that this is a legacy of quite a few decades of understanding and research. So as far as I'm aware, Gerald Pollack is one of the largest players in this space at the moment. But other researchers, including Gilbert Ling and Mei-Wan Ho, are two names that people might not have ever heard of, but who have been looking into this field quite diligently.
Yeah, absolutely. They're great names. And this actually, I want to say, this goes all the way back to, you know, Albert St. Georgi, who won the Nobel Prize for his, I believe it was his discovery of vitamin C, the synthesis of vitamin C. And he was the one who basically started to, I think, reframe his understanding of the fact that, wait a second, we've been studying the wrong thing. We've been studying these macromolecules, and really water is everything. So he basically said, the quote is, life really is water dancing to the tune of solids, meaning water is receiving the vibrations of these larger molecules, but it's truly water, the interaction with water and its reception of this information, and then how that plays out as a transduction or an initiation of a biochemical pathway that really is happening. And so he recognized it. Gilbert Ling, brilliant, absolutely. You even have people who, such as Luc Montagnier, who were virologists, right? I mean, another Nobel laureate in virology, who in the latter stages of his career, he turned towards water research. So that's what I find fascinating, because there's so many beautifully, like, well-renowned researchers in certain fields who, once they get tenure, once they, you know, get to the top of the pinnacle of their career, they start to study water. And it's because water is not understood yet. There's so many mysteries, but unlocking the mysteries really means unlocking what's happening, what I believe truly in our physical bodies and how our bodies interact, like I said, with the field around us.
So good. So let's talk about definitions, because I really like to be precise when I discuss a topic. So let's talk, how can we define bulk water? And then how can we define exclusion zone water and structured water? What are the difference between those three concepts as a start?
Yeah, perfect. That's great. So bulk water in the research, and then how we all refer to it in our bodies, is water that's in a liquid state, a true flowing liquid state, where the water molecules really are less organized. They don't have much structure in terms of how they bond with each other. Exclusion zone water is like on the other opposite end of that spectrum, where it's water that's highly organized. And that happens all throughout our cells. And we can go into the details on that. And as I said before, that's where water is very organized, and its organization gives it a negative charge. Liquid bulk water is neutral, and exclusion zone or easy water has a negative charge to it, which that is absolutely essential for health. I'm certain we'll dive into that. Structured water can be found inside of our bodies, and it also can be found in the water that we drink. Structured water is the water in its liquid state, so that we would find maybe potentially in our blood, interstitial fluid, or cerebrospinal fluid. So water truly in a liquid state, but the water molecules actually have the ability to receive energy and information, such as intention or even energy from things like crystals, like Vogel crystals and things like that. And the water molecules will organize and structure themselves into microgeometries, is what I've been referring to them as. meaning all of a sudden, instead of these water molecules randomly interacting with each other, you see them take on a geometric pattern. And that geometric pattern can be different. It's not the same type of geometry all the time. The geometry depends on the information that that bonding is encoding. So we have to recognize that vibration is how we receive and store and hold energy. It's like the language of the universe at all scales. And so when the water molecules, let's say they hear the word gratitude, or they feel the word gratitude, which they can do, as weird as that sounds, they can do, they'll reorganize and reorient themselves to hold on to the energy of that word and that sentiment and form a geometry. And that geometry will have a signature vibration. So the signature vibration of gratitude will basically align the water molecules into their own signature vibration of gratitude. And then we can drink that water with different structuring to it, and or we can structure our own water inside of us with different thoughts and feelings and emotions as well. And then again, that can also flow all the way through our bodies, for example, through our bloodstream.
And before any of the very scientifically focused people claim that is a woo-woo kind of statement, I think we're just beginning to understand that there is actually fundamental scientifically reproducible observations regarding these type of phenomena, and particularly I believe Veda Austin is someone who's really delving into this interaction of intention and structuring of water. So please stay with us, anyone who is of a more scientifically focused mind, because that is something that is at the cutting edge, I believe. And so we can have structured water inside of us, but would you say that most of the water, this gelled water, is more exclusion zone than structured inside, say, our blood vessels?
I would say our blood vessels have a changing combination of both always. It's how we actually maintain blood volume and blood flow. And so inside the arterial lining itself, we have this gelled water. And around all of the things, the hydrophilic surfaces, such as red blood cells, right? Water-loving surfaces, around all the water-loving surfaces of things like the red blood cells that are traveling through the bloodstream, they also create this exclusion zone gel. And that actually helps to drive blood flow, because if the exclusion zone is negatively charged on the endothelial lining and the red blood cells have this negative charge around them, that's called their zeta potential, two negatively charged entities will never interact strongly, right? There's a repelling force between them. And so that's how the red blood cells can propel themselves. And essentially, it's actually a very organized vortex flow. It's ideally, that's what it is. And that happens because of the repelling forces between the endothelial wall with this gelled water and then the gelled water around the red blood cells themselves. If that interaction starts to become too sluggish, right? If it feels like the blood is too sludgy, then the red blood cells in the endothelial lining, right, they can make endothelial nitric oxide. And so that will vasodilate, right? And it'll open things up, and that'll actually create more bulk water and less gelled water, and vice versa. It's hypothesized, and this is Dr. Seneff's research, about how then that ENOS, that endothelial nitric oxide enzyme, can also make sulfate. And sulfate is really rich in the gel of the endothelium. And so either it's like an either or. We can either make more bulk water if we need more flow, or we can make more gelled water if we need to have more structure and more organization through it. And so it's just this beautiful system that's always interacting.
That is an amazing thought. And I discussed that with Stephen Hussey and someone that you've talked to as well. And I truly believe that what you've just described is underlying how we prevent cardiovascular diseases, and specifically with regard to sunlight interactions on those dynamics. Again, something we might talk about later. But let's continue this definition and these the definitions that we're building up for everyone. So metabolic water, what is metabolic water and how does that relate to what we've talked about?
Metabolic water is the water that's made by the mitochondria and or recycled in the mitochondria, mainly the mitochondrial pathways. There's a lot of water recycling and water generation that happens with the mitochondria. So as you're aware, Max, at step 4 of the mitochondrial electron transport chain, that is called cytochrome C oxidase. And that's where the electron flow combines with oxygen and hydrogen and makes water. That water that is H2O, that's liquid water at the time, anytime that water comes into contact with another hydrophilic surface, another water-loving surface, it automatically structures itself into this gelled exclusion zone. The majority of the water inside of our cells is maintained because of the mitochondria being able to both produce and recycle water for us. So if mitochondria become impaired for any reason, that means our intracellular water status, which also would be our intracellular charge status, this healthy negative charge that we need inside of the cells, becomes compromised. So that's metabolic water. And because the mitochondria are making it, hopefully it is deuterium depleted. That's the ideal situation, is that those mitochondria make that water deuterium depleted for us.
Great. And you brought up the final definition that I was going to ask you to explain for everyone, which is deuterium depleted water and how that relates to its structure and potential role in the exclusion zone.
Yeah, sure. So deuterium, to understand deuterium depleted water, let's define deuterium first. Science gives things silly names, right? Deuterium is just another version of hydrogen. So there's three different variations of hydrogen that are called isotopes. And if we need to understand hydrogen, we got to go back to maybe the periodic table of elements and see that it's the very first element on the periodic table. And hydrogen has, because it's the first element, it has one proton in the nucleus and one electron. I don't actually believe that the electron circles the proton, but that's that's a whole nother topic at some point, Max. So if we go back to the periodic table of elements, we'll recognize that hydrogen contains one proton and one electron. And that version of hydrogen is called protium. Hydrogen can also exist as not just a proton and an electron, but a proton with a neutron and an electron. That is deuterium. We're not going to worry about tritium. That's not something that we're going to encounter, hopefully, on a regular basis. So deuterium, because it is a proton and a neutron together, that essentially doubles the size. I liken it to hydrogen number one. The protium version of hydrogen is just a basketball as the proton. Hydrogen number two is two basketballs put together. And so why does this deuterium matter? Well, this deuterium has the potential to get into the mitochondria in what's called the inner membrane space, which is the space between the outer and inner membrane of the mitochondria. And that's where hydrogen is designed to build up this pressure gradient. And this pressure gradient is what actually causes hydrogen then to spin through the ATPase at step five of the electron transport chain to drive the synthesis of ATP. But that ATPase is designed for protium. It's designed for one basketball at a time. And all of a sudden, if you throw a double basketball, a deuterium, into that motor, that spinning motor, you can jam it up. And if you jam up the motor in the ATPase, you stop producing adequate ATP. You also change the mitochondrial membrane potential and electron flow, meaning you pretty much shut down the system, right? You create mitochondria that are no longer making water or ATP efficiently anymore. And that is what we call a version of mitochondrial dysfunction.
Fantastic. So deuterium depleted water is something that people can buy. And anyone who's listened to my episodes with Gabor Shomlai and Dr. Laszlo Boros are aware of that. And it's obviously recommended, or it's an option as an adjunctive oncological cancer kind of tool. So the deuterium depleted water that perhaps we're buying would not necessarily be structured, and it might simply just be a bulk water that is low in deuterium. Is that correct?
That is correct. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. So I'm glad that we've gone through all those topics, and hopefully people can have in their mind these distinct definitions. So as it relates to biological function, I think it's worth to explain what happens to this water inside our bodies with regard to our light environment, because you mentioned a couple of key concepts with regard to charge, with regard to battery function, with regard to energy. So what does the light do to this water inside us?
Sure. So to understand that, we want to understand exclusion zone water and some properties there. So as I said before, this exclusion zone water will form spontaneously next to all biological surfaces, hydrophilic surfaces. And so that means that inside of our cells is just a jam-packed space, basically full of these hydrophilic surfaces. And it's been known for quite some time that a healthy cellular interior has a negative charge to it. And I think what's been interesting is to kind of dive into the research and read all of the different hypothesized pumps and channels that have been presented, because originally when it was thought that the water didn't have a charge, it was neutral, they had to really invent reasons and mechanisms as to why the interior of the cell was mostly full of potassium and negatively charged, and why the exterior of the cell was mostly full of sodium and still had a charge to it, but was less negatively charged. And so that being said, you have things like the sodium potassium pump hypothesis, which this is going to sound like heresy probably to a lot of the people listening to this, but Gilbert Ling pretty much dismantled that, because he said the amount of ATP required to run that pump would need to magnify it tenfold in order just to run this so-called sodium potassium pump. So he was the first one to hypothesize that the water actually played a role in maintaining this negative charge. He didn't quite get the arrangement right, but he was definitely on to the idea that the water inside its organization alone gave it a negative charge. And so to understand how water can give negative charge, we have to go back to that structuring. What happens when exclusion zone water forms is that there's the picture an O at the top, right? A big O and H's coming off, right? Two H's and an O. That's the chemical symbol for water. An OH portion branches off and forms this structured lattice that we call exclusion zone water. And that leaves an H by itself. That H actually gets kicked out of the exclusion zone and it forms its own little zone called the proton zone, because a naked hydrogen is just a proton, right? And so a proton zone forms right next to that negatively charged exclusion zone. So the exclusion zone maintains this negative entity, the OH bond that organizes itself. The proton zone maintains the positive entity, that just the proton. And an adequate amount of exclusion zone water means that the interior of the cell will stay negatively charged. And certainly the proton zone is needed. We need some of that proton zone because that's called charge separation. It's the same reason that batteries have a positive end and a negative end. You essentially have to isolate the electricity in order for it to flow once you plug it into a completed circuit, right? And so that's what's happening inside of our cells. It's isolating or it's separating these charges so that ultimately when it comes into contact with various proteins or biochemical processes, it can help to facilitate electron flow. That's what biochemistry is, right? It's basically an exchange of electrons all the way throughout. It's just electron flow that gets stimulated. And we now know that water plays a huge role in that because of its ability to charge separate. So water maintains this healthy interior cellular charge. It also helps to allow for electron flow for biochemical processes, what we would call redox reactions. And it also, because it's gelled, it helps proteins and receptors maintain the appropriate configuration. The gel provides a structure so that a receptor, receptors rely on a correct shape, proteins rely on to have to be the correct shape to be functioning optimally. So if all of a sudden a protein is not optimal because it doesn't have adequate exclusion zone water, now when we do strategies that we'll talk about in a second that maintain this exclusion zone water or boost it, the gel can reform, and all of a sudden we now have functioning proteins and receptors again because they're in their correct configuration. And the way that you alluded to earlier was our interaction with sunlight, because Dr. Pollack's lab found that when we apply specific wavelength frequencies of light to the body or to even a petri dish, right, studying this in the lab, that the exclusion zone can expand. And the wavelength range is infrared light, specifically around the 3000 nanometer mark, which is on the cusp kind of around mid to far infrared. And that wavelength range then will, when it's being penetrates our bodies or it is shown onto a petri dish, that exclusion zone expands fourfold or more. So all of a sudden we've got more negative charge. We've got more potential charge separation. So that's potential energy, like a battery, if you will. And then that just also maintains that healthy cellular environment, because the voltage, that charge inside of the cell, determines even things like how well oxygen is going to be able to diffuse and be delivered into the cell. So, I mean, it really is everything, in my opinion.
The iconoclastic kind of implications of what Gilbert Ling found, it's difficult to comprehend, but he essentially is challenging one of these central dogmas of biology that that why is the cell negatively charged? And it's definitely something that isn't appreciated or has far from yet reached mainstream acceptance. So very interesting to discuss in such a challenging idea to what is the prevailing thought in this biochemical focused biomedical structure. The concept of redox, can you talk a little bit about that as it relates to what we've talked about? Because the word gets thrown around quite a lot, but how do you think about it, and what do you think is the most appropriate way to use the term redox?
Sure. Yeah. So redox is actually known in the conventional medical literature. The re stands for reduction and the ox stands for oxidation. And that's describing the reactions that are taking place inside of our bodies. And reduction basically means something is gaining electrons, and oxidation means something is losing electrons. And so that's, like I said, that's what biochemistry is. It's this exchange of electrons. Something donates electrons. Now this thing has gained them. It's been reduced. The one that lost, it's been oxidized. Well, we don't want too much oxidation, right? That's, I think everyone's heard that word, oxidative stress or oxidation, and that actually can drive inflammatory cascades. And so that now this one needs to be reduced. It needs to get electrons from somewhere in order for it not to be an inflammatory species for too long. And so then it's going to gain electrons. So the whole of biochemistry is really this idea of giving electrons and losing electrons and receiving them and losing them. And that is a redox. However, what I think mainstream and actually probably functional medicine gets wrong about this is that the assumption is, well, in order to maintain an appropriate amount of redox reactions, we need to supplement antioxidants because that's what antioxidants are. They can anti-oxidize things because they've got electrons to donate. And that is true to an extent, but what's been overlooked is the fact that the water in and of itself, because it has a negative charge, has the potential to be its own redox pile, if you will. That's how Mae Wan Ho described it so beautifully. She called it a redox pile so that it can donate as needed. And we have to make sure we have adequate amounts of charge in it for that to be maintained. So that's why things like earthing are also beneficial, because earthing brings those electrons into our body via the surface of the earth through our skin. And that actually goes into the exclusion zone to maintain a healthy charge of that exclusion zone so that it can maintain its redox status. So I just view redox as, do you have adequate charge to calm the oxidation? And that happens through the understanding of water and electrons.
Great explanation. The other concept that is tangential, but I think it's worth talking about, is the source of these electrons, because you mentioned grounding, and that is a key source of electrons and simple absorption or passage of these electrons from the ground, which is carrying a negative charge. Where else, other than, and obviously food, so food is what people, the chief source that people are aware of as inputs into the electron transport chain. But where else can we get these electrons from to maintain this charge status of our body and therefore our redox status?
Yeah, that's a great question. Another place is a different wavelength range of sunlight. We know that the ultraviolet wavelength range of sunlight can strike the exclusion zone water and charge it. The literature calls it a plasma of free electrons. So essentially it adds energy into that exclusion zone to give it more negative charge. And here's the thing, right? Let's talk about the fact that sunlight, all that UV light has to do is strike the skin, because UV light doesn't penetrate as deeply as infrared, but it only has to strike the skin because this exclusion zone water network is everywhere. It's a continuous pathway, essentially, because the water is everywhere. So you want to view your body as a web, essentially, or like interconnecting highways of this exclusion zone water. And because it's linked as a lattice, it becomes a semiconductor. The electrons in it are no longer localized to one molecule and instead become part of the greater system. And so that's why anything that we do to add to the electron status of exclusion zone water can impact where the electron demand is anywhere in the body. It's through this interconnected highway. And so with exclusion zone water and that ultraviolet light, beautiful. Sunlight's great because we can expand it. Essentially, we can expand the battery and we can charge it even more when we get the ultraviolet on the skin as well. Another place that we get go ahead.
No, please keep going.
Okay. Another place we do get electrons is through movement. Our connective tissue, which maybe, again, it's called a lot of different names. It could be called fascia. When it gets smaller, it's called the extracellular matrix. When it gets smaller, it's called the cytoskeleton or the nuclear matrix. But all of it, that is also liquid crystalline. It's connective tissue that's ordered. And because it is liquid crystalline, it has an inherent property. In the same way that a quartz crystal keeps time by generating a piezoelectric signal, like a little spark, essentially, if you will, that happens in our connective tissue as well. Anytime we move, we are generating electrons in this connective tissue network. And those electrons, again, then have the ability to essentially charge the water and provide energy or redox, essentially, wherever it's needed.
Fantastic. Can you speak about melanin and its relation to this idea of charge separation of water? Because was that perhaps what you were referring to in terms of the effect or the pathway by which ultraviolet light was having this ability to no separate pathway?
It's a separate pathway. So melanin is different, and I'd love to go into that, but this is actually an inherent property of this was, if people want to dive into this, this was the really brilliant research from two additional water researchers who, you know, in the water nerd world, they're really well known, but their names probably won't mean much. But it's Emilio Delgudici and Giuliana Preparata. They described for decades what they called the coherent domain of water. That was just another word for exclusion zone, right? Like they were also studying the exclusion zone, and they found that when ultraviolet light was shown onto the exclusion zone, that literally excited this water and allowed for greater electron flow to happen, greater energy, essentially, if you will, because excited water is also a better conductor of electricity and electrons. And so they described it as a plasma. It generated a plasma of free electrons. So it's a little bit different than the melanin pathway that you're alluding to.
Sure. And that's very helpful. The melanin pathway is, I think, relevant because it's something that particularly Dr. Jack Cruz talks a lot about. And this idea that the inherent property of the melanin molecule is able to reversibly charge, separate water, and therefore liberate electrons. How do you think about that? Or how do you fit that into the model that we're building for people?
It's redox. It's redox 101 right there. Because when you split a water molecule, so let's picture it this way, because people are like, how does melanin split a water molecule? Remember, every molecule is surrounded by a hydration shell of water, meaning water and melanin are inherently inseparable. They're always together. And melanin we find on the surfaces of our skin. We also find it deeper in our body, such as in the brain, for example, as neuromelanin. And anytime melanin interacts with light, it has the ability that light essentially is enough energy to take some of the water that's surrounding the melanin molecule and completely split it. And when it actually splits two molecules, and it splits it into molecular hydrogen, H2, and then molecular oxygen, O2. And these are electron donors, essentially. It's another way. That's why molecular hydrogen is all the rage these days. And there's so much research indicating that it has the ability to help reverse so many chronic illness conditions. But we generate it ourselves, right? We can make it through our skin and inside of our bodies through light exposure to our skin. And so that just adds to that charged status of our bodies. And then the beauty of this is that melanin will create it, but it doesn't become, all of a sudden, if the hydrogen donates its electrons, it doesn't become an oxidant, because melanin has the ability, the water there has the ability to reform a water molecule. And so that's the whole, I know you know this, Dr. Max, but that's the whole antioxidant pathway right there. That's like, you look at hydrogen peroxide, the end product is always, you want to generate water. That's key, because that water then is not going to be reactive anymore. Melanin in and of itself will split the water, allow that water to be essentially an electron donor, and then reform the water molecule all in one.
Yeah, it's so interesting that there's these independent pathways that we've evolved to basically make use of the sun. And melanin, obviously, it has this its own semiconductive properties, and was very, very useful in the way that it's imbuing organisms with an extra ability to harness sunlight. Where are the Where are the best places, or what resources have you come across for understanding these energy properties of melanin? Because I have, Dr. Arturo Herrera is possibly one of the researchers that has done a lot of work on this. Is there anyone else that you would recommend people listen to or read to understand these melanin properties?
His work is by far the most comprehensive, and his book would be the best way to go about it. He sets a nice stage of showing how melanin is really ubiquitous throughout all living creatures. And then it also contains all of his publications all organized. So you'll see how he's researched this in response or in relationship to eye health. He's researched it in relationship to Alzheimer's disease, and it's all there cataloged in one unit. So it's not an easy read. It doesn't read like a book per se, but I would say that that's the best place for someone who really wants to start diving into what he always calls the unexpected property of melanin to split the water molecule in and like Alzheimer's disease blindness. Like he has studied it in so many ways. His would be by far the best to get started.
The implication for that, and obviously the other mechanism that you described with regard to UV light, and in terms of practicalities, is I think about this idea of the solar callus, and it's a topic that I'm particularly interested in at the moment because it's a course that I'm releasing soon. But to me, it makes sense that if we can cultivate our melanin in our skin, cutaneous eumelanin in our skin, pheomelanin, and then we are potentially increasing our ability to harvest energy from the sun safely in a way, both in that melanin-dependent and independent pathway, because that's going to prevent us from burning and able us to expose ourselves to more UV light without sunburning. What are your thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly what it is. And it's why... you see people who live in high solar yield environments, oftentimes it appears as though they need less food, or there's oftentimes in these cultures and populations a very unique ability to do long distance running without the same sort of nutritional requirements that other populations seem to need. And I think a lot of it has to do with these inherent properties of melanin, for sure. And it's also why people who maybe have less melanin in their skin will need to do other things to help to maintain their energy status in terms of cold exposure, right? A cold plunge, because that in and of itself will help the body become more energy efficient in its electron flow and electron utilization. And so just an interesting strategy to understand that, yes, build melanin as much as you can. And that's probably why certain populations and cultures do have these unique sports and athletic capabilities.
Yeah, fascinating. And I think Tristan Scott posted a video, and that was an analysis of a recent marathon runner who I think he did some kind of record. He was Kenyan or Ethiopian, one of those Central African, East African origin, and he was eating oatmeal for breakfast, which is, you know, not necessarily the first choice of human nutrition in terms of nutrient density. But I think the point was that this is someone who was perfectly adapted in his ancestral environment with a massive solar yield running on his home turf. The food didn't matter as much as the fact that he was deriving all this energy while he was running from the sun in his appropriate setting.
Yeah, oh, that's fascinating. Absolutely. I've heard Usain Bolt didn't have the best diet in the world, right, when he was running, and in terms of potentially liking fast food, and did absolutely fine for himself.
Fantastic. Well, that's some really great background and of the theory behind water. And you've talked about some very, very interesting concepts and opened some doors for a lot of people to continue their own investigation. So let's talk about the practicalities now of how we can incorporate those concepts into water on our daily life. And so maybe we won't specifically talk about the sun and the circadian rhythm stuff, because that is something I've talked about at length, and so have you, in terms of getting morning sun, getting full spectrum sun, getting infrared from the sun. I would really encourage people to go back and listen to my early episodes to understand how we can best use the sun and avoid artificial light. But let's talk about the theory or the approach to drinking water. So common things that people want to know is, should I drink an arbitrary amount of water? Should I add minerals to my water? And should I drink to thirst versus, you know, a prescribed amount? So what are your thoughts around that topic?
Yeah, drinking water is it's an interesting one. I think first and foremost, we need to understand that when we drink water, it very quickly gets absorbed. It doesn't necessarily go through the same absorption pathway that food nutrients do. It gets absorbed both orally, and then there's fast absorption in the stomach itself. And so the initial place where the water we drink affects hydration status is in our blood volume. And the blood, as you know, wants to be tightly regulated. We want just the right amount of fluid in our blood volume, if you will. If that drops too much, that's a stress signal to the body. And then the body actually turns on a histamine cascade, which we can talk about in a second. However, that being said, if the blood volume has enough, then that's where at the capillaries, the fluid of the blood can leave the capillaries and bathe the interstitial space, the space between the cells. And then some of that fluid, yes, does go intracellularly. But as I said before, the vast majority of the water inside of our cells is due to our mitochondrial production. And so it is, however, important to maintain healthy blood volume because we don't want to turn on this histamine cascade. Do you know Dr. Batmanghalidze? Have you read his stuff? Dr. Batmanghalidze has written so many books. He was an Iranian physician who was kept prisoner during the Iranian Revolution. And he, being a doctor, they brought prisoners to him in this very stressful prison situation. And all he had to give these prisoners was water to drink. And he saw time and time again how it reduced pain so drastically. And so he started to research the mechanism to the extent that he actually was asked to leave early from the prison. He wanted to stay to finish out his observation period. So he stayed in prison longer than he needed to because he was so shocked with how well, when you understood hydration status in people, how much that impacted things like their pain levels and even their tissue deterioration. And so he found his life of research was that when the blood volume gets too low, which is going to be more likely to happen in a stressful situation because mitochondria, when they're stressed, they're going to be poor water producers as well. And so the stressful situation would result in what he called chronic unintentional dehydration. And when someone's blood volume drops to a certain extent, histamine turns on. And he saw that histamine was a drought management system. And so he basically saw what he saw was that histamine's job then at that point was to direct blood and fluid to where it was absolutely needed. And it would shut off in other parts. So it really was this drought management pathway in the body, which was good temporarily, right? Because at some point then someone would come across water and then they would potentially be able to rehydrate their blood volume. But if it was chronic in terms of we were in a very dehydrating environment for extended periods of time, he saw he found a pathway where histamine elevated certain cytokines that would lead to tissue destruction. And that tissue destruction would also, those pathways would also do things like fragment DNA and RNA, which has its own implications. And that would just further then drive things like autoimmune disease. And so he connected this chronic unintentional dehydration with so many different autoimmune conditions via these cytokine pathways. And so I'm of the opinion that the amount of water that one needs to drink is dependent a lot on their environment and their mental state and how functioning their mitochondria are. If you are living, you know, in a very chill place where you can get a lot of free energy essentially from your environment, you're not surrounded by a lot of non-native EMFs, which deplete exclusion zone water, you're not under artificial light, which also impacts mitochondria and their ability to make that water, if you're not super stressed out, and your mitochondria can use fat as a fuel source, you don't necessarily have to drink a ton of water if you don't want to, because your mitochondria will literally pull fat from the food you eat and from storage and make metabolic water that then can be distributed into the body wherever it's needed. That is really the theory behind why Dr. Boros says he doesn't drink a lot of water. And if he feels like he needs to be hydrated, he drinks some olive oil, right? It's because he's trained his mitochondria and his environment essentially to allow him to do just this. However, a lot of people are in environments and are in stress, live in a stressful state. And I do believe that they have to drink adequate amounts of water during the day. The question becomes, what does adequate look like for people? And do you need to remineralize? I think you, step one, you got to filter out the garbage, right? So that's the most important thing that we focus on, is getting rid of all the toxins that are in the water. That being said, I find that when appropriate remineralization happens in the water, it is better absorbed, because minerals give the water charge, and charge enhances its absorption. So you maybe come across patients. I've had clients in the past who have said, "Well, Carrie, I drink 3 liters of water a day, and I'm just peeing every 20 minutes." Turns out that the water that they were drinking was reverse osmosis water. That would mean it eliminated, yes, all the toxins, but it also eliminated all the minerals from the water. These are people who are drinking water, but they're truly not absorbing it well, because the water, when it doesn't get absorbed well, the body has no choice but to basically flush it out via the kidneys. So you're going to pee a lot. I've had clients who have played around with quinton minerals, which is an isotonic version of seawater, essentially, meaning it's really rich in minerals. And when you overdo minerals in your water, when you overconsume too many minerals in your water, you're going to get diarrhea, right? Your colon has the ability to say, nope, we don't need to absorb any more minerals. We're going to flush those out of the system. So I find that the body has a built-in mechanism to know if you're absorbing water well. You don't want the diarrhea. So you don't want that many minerals that you get the diarrhea. You don't want to be peeing every 20 to 30 minutes. And you want your urine in general to be of a lighter, like a very lightish yellow, not excessively clear all the time, right? But a light, light yellow. If that's what's happening to you, like you're peeing every couple of hours or so, your urine's light yellow, you're drinking the good quality water with a little bit of minerals added to it, I say that's good enough. You're generally hydrated, in my opinion, at that point. Nuance there for people who have things like POTS, who may need more minerals and more water for things like blood volume. But, you know, obviously there's a lot of case by case individuality that goes into this.
And so it seems to me the hierarchy of waters that we could drink in an ideal world would start with something like a spring water that we know to be having been tested to be free of contaminants, and perhaps obviously above a remineralized reverse osmosis water. Is that an idea in terms of, if you had to put together a hierarchy of best to least suitable water sourcing strategies?
Yeah, that's great. And I also love natural spring water that comes from higher altitudes and latitudes, because it's going to be more deuterium depleted as well. And so, yeah, if you have, you know, if you can find some beautiful spring water, like one of my colleagues at Kelly Bento has access to a beautiful source that has, I believe it's like 140 ppm deuterium. That's good for drinking water, right? Where, because you can find it at 150, 155. And that the best part about the spring water is that not only does it contain great minerals, but it also contains its own structure. So it is a natural form of structured water, which does appear to be better absorbed and utilized by the body.
Yeah, fantastic. And that's something that I hope more water springs will popularize, which is the deuterium content of their water. And anyone listening, if you know, if you source your water from a local spring, please insist that they get it tested for deuterium so we can build some kind of a database. It'd be great to have that in Australia, especially. It's a bit smaller than the US, but to have a database of where we can get water and the deuterium content of that water. Obviously, the lower latitude is going to be associated with less deuterium content, but yeah, it would be interesting to know that. So say someone can get a spring water, that might be the best. They can buy big glass, even glass bidons. That, to me, that would be the best way to source water. What is second on the list? Say that we it's impractical or not financially appropriate for someone to buy and bring in spring water. What is second on the list for you?
Second on the list would be either reverse osmosis or distillation for water purification, followed by your own remineralization. And I always do like to structure the water because water has memory, right? And meaning I don't necessarily want water to contain the vibrational signature of the toxins and the pharmaceuticals that were in it at one point. And so, yeah, so reverse osmosis or distillation. than literally a couple drops. So, you know, I mean, I just have this sitting here on my desk. This is one version of just like a trace minerals that I've used. It literally per liter, it's just a couple of drops. It's nothing like, you know, putting massive amounts of salt into your water, if you will, but just enough, again, to give the water this ionic charge that allows you to better absorb it.
And what are some of these contaminants that we're removing from our water when we either filter it or distill it? What are the most common or, in your mind, the most toxic and damaging contaminants of water?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I hate to say it, but there's so many in common tap water these days. One that's really ubiquitous in where I live is fluoride. Fluoride really is detrimental. You know, from the quantum perspective, it's very detrimental to the connective tissue network. It turns on collagenase, or it really activates these collagenase enzymes that break down collagen. And also fluoride, it has been shown to do something that's called lower the dielectric constant of water, meaning a dielectric constant is just a fancy way of saying how much charge, how much energy can that water hold? It's like how much can that battery maintain, be charged up? And when there's fluoride, too much fluoride present in the system.
I'm really glad you brought fluoride up, because that is something that is ubiquitously added to the water supply, basically all over the world. And it's used predominantly to prevent dental caries. But as you've explained, it is something that we don't want if we're understanding the body as an electromagnetic vehicle and that is relying on charge and electricity. So yeah, it makes sense to me that we need to get rid of fluoride. And the other point about it is that there's no role of these fluorine or fluoride in biological systems. I'm not aware that any organism voluntarily incorporates that into any of its biological processes. Fluorine. So
hang on, really, really quick on that. We do incorporate the naturally occurring fluorine into things like into our dental enamel. This is why this confusion got there in the first place. Because fluorine does help to maintain, like, for example, if a client has translucent tips of the teeth, I utilize these things called cell mineral salts, cell tissue salts, which is a different topic altogether. But there is a calcium fluorine one that is great to help to reestablish healthy dental enamel. However, the fluoride does not do the same as a naturally occurring fluorine. And so the assumption was, well, yeah, we do have some fluorine in the teeth. We might as well put a bunch of fluoride into the water system, water supply, and just make the assumption that it's going to help with things like cavities and tooth health. And that's not the case.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting for sure. So the process of reverse osmosis, for people that don't know, is a highly effective way of getting rid of essentially impurities. But as you mentioned with your experience of your clients who are drinking unremineralized water, it is essentially deplete of or lacking in sufficient electrolytes and minerals to essentially work as a good human hydration. So I think that speaks to the role of natural water in having a degree of dissolved magnesium, sodium, potassium that our body needs. So, and are you aware specifically of the amounts that we should be looking to put back into, say, reverse osmosis or something like that? Those salt drops are sufficient in terms of the proportions of trace minerals.
Yeah, you know, just a little bit is needed, because it's less about, we don't get a ton of our minerals from water, frankly. So it's not about repleting minerals through the water we consume. It's about just enhancing the absorption of the water that we consume, because we want to be able to pull that water in and utilize it. So just a couple drops generally is all that's needed. If you dive into the research on natural spring water, you will see that different springs around the world may be higher in things like magnesium or sulfate, and that those have been associated with certain health properties. So there is this idea that the minerals may contribute to health and physiology, but for all intents and purposes here, we get your minerals from good quality food, but just make sure your water is remineralized slightly so you can better absorb it.
Great. That makes a lot of sense to me. In terms of deuterium depleted water, and specifically deuterium water that's been deuterium depleted to a known, therapeutic parts per million, do you recommend or do you see any use of deuterium depletion, depleted water, outside of very specific medical indications, say cancer? Or would you perhaps just recommend that people get a lower naturally occurring spring water that has lower amount of deuterium?
Yeah, the cool part about deuterium is that we've got ways to sequester it and deplete it naturally in our bodies when if we utilize it. So well before it recommending deuterium depleted water, I always say, are you maximizing infrared exposures? Because we sequester our deuterium in the exclusion zone. Because deuterium has a higher bonding affinity or binding affinity to oxygen, right? Almost 10 times stronger. So that's why a protium is going to get kicked out. And that protium is mobile, that proton zone. That's where that protium actually can go to places like the intermembrane space. But we're trying to ensure it is a protium because we want to maintain the exclusion zone. And that will hold the deuterium. So I want people to max out that, max out sunlight on the skin, sweat. Make sure you're pooping regularly. These are ways that we just naturally can deplete deuterium. Then if someone's concerned with something like cancer, for example, it never hurts to have deuterium levels tested because it's a very easy test to do. You know, a company like Lightwater will offer that. And you can just see what your deuterium number is. And if it is 150, 152, 154, it would probably behoove you to go on a key deuterium depletion strategy, which will involve deuterium depleted water. But deuterium depleted water by itself, while still eating really foods high in deuterium and not doing the things to sequester and have the body eliminate the deuterium naturally, really, in my opinion, doesn't do a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. There's no point in spending all that money on specific Hungarian deuterium depleted water if you're eating the McDonald's French fries and drinking the cans of Coke. So that's great advice. Maybe we can make a quick point about glyphosate, because if we're using a reverse osmosis filter, then we're going to remove this ubiquitous industrial herbicide glyphosate from our water. Why is glyphosate important both for deuterium and the exclusion zone?
Gosh, glyphosate, there's so many reasons why glyphosate is impactful. But what glyphosate really does is it just diminishes our body's ability to create exclusion zones in the first place. And it really, truly is happens where our connective tissue is, our collagen. And as you know, collagen is our most it's the most protein we have in our body is in the shape and structure of collagen, right? It's a huge component of our physical structure. And collagen has a very unique triple helix formation. And it wraps around itself. We need that. I'll talk about why we need that in a second. But what most people might not know is that collagen has the amino acid glycine as a very prominent, every third amino acid in collagen is glycine. And unfortunately, the gly in glyphosate looks very analogous to a naturally occurring glycine amino acid. And so we can literally replace the glycine in our connective tissue with glyphosate. And that changes the ability of the water of the connective tissue to fold appropriately. And so if these triple helixes aren't forming, we're actually not getting what are called water nanotubes forming, which sounds wild, but there's such beautiful research to indicate that that's literally our high-speed communication system throughout our body is through these water nanotubes. In addition, if glyphosate is there, we're again not creating adequate amounts of exclusion zone water either. So we're shrinking that conduit as well through which we can funnel electrons to help to establish healthy redox in our tissues too. And so this connective tissue is just such a huge component of our physical bodies, and glyphosate is just detrimental to that tissue in so many ways. And not to mention that glyphosate is a mitochondrial toxin as well. And so that's just a double whammy right there.
There's so many reasons to get glyphosate out of your diet and out of your environment. So it's, great advice. Do you ever test urinary glyphosate levels in your clients?
I haven't. I just don't run a ton of tests these days because in general, my assumption is that unless someone has really been diligent about eating either certified organic and or small farm where they use chemical-free growing strategies, unless someone's been doing that for years and years and years, they're still going to be impacted likely by glyphosate. And so we just do the strategies I know to help the body get rid of it and then establish healthy exclusion zone water and healthy mitochondrial function. And that pretty much solves the problem. If needed, there are certain glyphosate specific strategies that I have used with clients to help get rid of it. But I don't test urinary. I just kind of go based on symptoms.
Yeah, fair enough. So someone has put their water through a reverse osmosis filter, or they have perhaps distilled it and then remineralized it. What is next? You mentioned structuring. So how can we get the benefits of structuring? And are there specific clinical evidence of benefit of say structuring your water, or is it inferred kind of deduced benefit?
Oh no, there's clinical research. I mean, drinking structured water has shown improvements on HRV, on blood sugar regulation, on because of HRV, you can imagine it's also been implicated in improvements in anxiety and depression as well. So yeah, no, there's a lot of actually, I wouldn't say a lot, but there is probably at least half a dozen good articles that I've read on structured water in both human health, and then an additional amount of articles on structured water in things like animals and plants. And that's where, again, I like to look into that as well, because plants and animals don't necessarily know, oh, this water is structured, so it's going to give me a health benefit, right? And so if there's been poorly controlled human experiments, then you can see that actually there's a lot of structured water evidence in the plant and animal literature to indicate better, bigger crop yield, healthier size of various livestock, chickens, their eggs, more nutrient density. I mean, there's a lot of different things that have been studied in that case. And so there is research behind it, but just also, just anecdotally or just, you know, viscerally, right? If water can hold information, which it can, and if you want, we can talk about that. Maybe we'll save that for another time, but water can hold information. And so if water can hold information, I want it to hold information that is of benefit to my body, because literally if it's not going to have good quality structure to it, it's not necessarily going to be, helping to put my body in a thriving state anymore. It can actually go against it. One of my colleagues, Jen Isabel Friends, describes tap water as traumatized. Literally, not only are you getting all the toxins from it, but the structure is such that it is really ugly looking water when you look at it from the that molecular level. So you want water to have structure too, because it's not just that there's proven scientific health benefits that it has, but the water is an antenna for energy and information. What I drink, in the same way that I don't want to put garbage on my body in terms of toxic personal care products, in terms like that's very similar, in my opinion, to water that doesn't have structure to it. Yeah, are we going to drink it, and is it going to kill us? No. But can we choose a better quality substance that gives us actually more energy and vitality? Absolutely. And that's what structured water does. And there's so many ways that we can actually structure our water. It doesn't have to get super fancy, or if you want to, you can spend a heck of a lot of money as well.
So what are some options for structuring? Because there are some products, one particularly called Analemma Wand. Is that something that people should be investing in, or can we get these benefits of structuring without spending money?
Well, you can get it without spending money for sure. Like that's hands down. I mean, I have an Analemma Wand. The way I test a lot of my stuff, because water structure is hard. I mean, I don't have the GDV Curlian photography to, you know, see changes in the water, both the energy, if we structure it versus unstructured. I mean, there are researchers out there who do that. I use Veda's technique. So for people who are not familiar, Veda Austin has a water crystallography technique where you essentially flash freeze the water and it shows on a grander scale, because water, everything is fractal. So on a grander scale, it shows whether the water organizes itself into structures and patterns, or whether it just kind of looks amorphous, which would be unstructured typically. And so, yeah, the Analemma Wand will structure water, right? It will form these beautiful ferns and hexagons. That's happy water. That's structured water. But I've done the same thing by taking my glass of reverse osmosis remineralized water and holding it to my heart and thinking happy thoughts into the water. As weird as that sounds, right? Same thing, right? I put that water, I flash freeze it, looks the same. Tap water looks ugly when you freeze it in comparison. So you can do these different types of, and so you can actually take tap water, the same sample, right? Essentially, and take one and think happy thoughts. The other one, you just freeze it straight up, and you'll see the same sample of water will have different structure based on whether you've provided loving energy and intention, compassion, gratitude, whatever feeling you might want. But it's why I think, Max, that every culture that I know of, from history's past, has had a habit of prayer or gratitude prior to a meal, giving thanks, right? And giving thanks, is it just to give thanks, or did it actually somehow change the energetic quality of what they were about to consume? I think through understanding water, it actually changed the energetic qualities.
That is a very interesting concept. As I said earlier, very at the forefront of water research and understanding how this fits in the physics and the science to a more metaphysical kind of concept. So that's very interesting. Maybe we could finish on some opinions about water storage options, and some people advocating for things like copper storage, and other people store water in like glass or ceramic cisterns. And then maybe finally talk about hydrogen and how that relates to water.
Sure. Yeah. You know, water storage, I have found that a couple ones that I really like. I haven't tested copper myself. It's just, I know copper has been utilized quite some time because it's got such a high energetic quality to it. It's quite conductive. It's not something that's in my wheelhouse to speak to. What I have tested are various glass, such as the Blue Bottle Love Company and the Flaska. Have you heard of either of those? I have a Flaska right here. Flaska is just a company that actually, this is going to sound woo, right? But they've actually, in terms of how they've structured the bottle, and then shown that can imbibe structure, like coherent geometry, essentially, into how the water molecules organize themselves. So I prefer glass typically. And I use Flaska and Blue Bottle Love. And again, I tested those with Davis Technique. I like them quite a bit. Interestingly, though, if we go to Victor Schauberger's research, Victor Schauberger was called the water wizard. And we don't have time to necessarily go into his history. But he showed that water loves to be stored in an egg-shaped container because of how etheric the ether or the zero-point energy actually implodes into the shape of an egg, creates a very good charge, essentially. It's a good charge reservoir. It's why eggs have that exact shape. Because not only are they deriving energy from the heat that mom sits on top of them, but they're also driving energy from their environment in the form of the zero point energy field. And the egg shape allows for the organization of that energy very, very effectively. And so egg shaped containers as well.
Great stuff. And hydrogen, there are products on the market that are supposedly to imbuing water with hydrogen that have various health claims, hydrogen tablets. How do you think about these? Is there benefit? Is there evidence of benefit? Or is this something that we shouldn't be worrying about?
Yeah, I actually think there's a massive amount. At last time I checked, I think there's over 1,500 research articles on molecular hydrogen and the health benefits of molecular hydrogen. And so I think we have to, first and foremost, there's two ways we can get this molecular hydrogen. And so the research divides it up. You can get it through what's called hydrogen-rich water. So essentially, like you said, dissolving hydrogen into water, hydrogen gas into water, or we can inhale it. I think the most potent way by far that we could utilize hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, is through inhalation. Again, I also want you to make it on your own via sunlight striking the melanin in your skin, right? So there's that aspect as well. But I do believe that in hydrogen inhalation therapy can be profoundly helpful. In terms of hydrogen-rich water, yes, there is some really compelling evidence there as well. And I have had I've had many anecdotal stories of people really finding that drinking molecular hydrogen or hydrogen-rich water was therapeutically very useful in their healing journeys. These days, the only company that I'm leaning towards in terms of a company that you can get a hydrogen machine that does both inhalation and dissolves hydrogen into the water is a company called Holy Hydrogen. They have the Lourdes Hydrofix machine. I was shown that I have a couple of colleagues utilizing it. I have a couple of clients utilizing it with very good success. And I just interviewed the hydrogen man. Do you know Greg, the hydrogen man? Basically a citizen scientist who has studied everything anyone ever wants to know about hydrogen, right? Did the hydrogen deep dive for his own healing journey. And he has really settled in on that being the best hydrogen machine out there. He's got so much anecdotal evidence from his clients and just people reaching out to him around the world who have said, hey, this has changed my life, right? It saved my life. And so I do think that there can be a big therapeutic benefit to molecular hydrogen. I just think the delivery has to be appropriate and consistent.
And how would that be different to deuterium depleted? How would hydrogen-rich water differ to deuterium-depleted water? Because you're obviously not deuterium-depleting the water by adding extra hydrogen to it.
But you're not necessarily adding deuterium. No, but no, you're adding – the hydrogen is an electron donor, right? So when you add electron donors into the water that you're drinking, you're essentially allowing this – so hydrogen is a very selective antioxidant. It works specifically on the hydroxyl radical, which is a very damaging free radical that when a pathway of oxidation happens through that that hydroxyl radical pathway, it's hard to calm. Molecular hydrogen specifically targets the hydroxyl radical. So it's very good at calming that inflammation by donating its electrons to calm the hydroxyl radical, if you will. And so you're bubbling hydrogen gas. So you're not consuming hydrogen in its protium form or deuterium. Like I'm not saying you're not going to get deuterium, right? You're consuming the gas form, which is going to be protium hydrogen. So the deuterium content of your water will not change. You know, if you're drinking 155 ppm, it's going to stay 155 ppm, right? Or 140, based on bubbling the gas into it. And water only dissolves so much hydrogen at atmospheric pressure, 1.6 ppm. And so that, if you do that regularly, that's a therapeutic amount of the hydrogen gas to be consuming on a regular basis. But buyer beware, right? In terms of the product that you're using in order to do that.
Yeah. No, great advice. Thanks for clearing that up. And I agree that, that under specific situations, you might want to investigate specific products. And like I said, it's on each person, and you said to do their own research, but it makes sense to get it from nature where we can and promote our own endogenous ability to get that. So that's been an amazing podcast, Kerry. I think we've covered a heap of information.
This has been such a great chat with you. I think we went over so much when it comes to water. So I'm just thrilled to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you, and see you next time.